readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I can't believe it's nearly July. But summer's more relaxed pace is a pleasure. There's a bit more time to relax and read. Yep, the living is easy, but hey, just because it's sizzling out there doesn't mean your brain has to turn to mush. There are some great new titles in the nonfiction world that will fire your synapses and keep you up to date with history, politics, sports, and more. I bet there are some selections in the show you've been meaning to pick up. Here's your chance to preview them as we turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need MagicBuzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The MagicBuzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. MagicBuzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at MagicBuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@MagicBuzz.com. MagicBuzz, we're there when you can't be.
Before Madeleine Albright turned 12, her life was shaken by the Nazi invasion of her native Czechoslovakia, World War II, and the rise of communism. Albright's experiences provide a lens through which to view the most tumultuous dozen years in modern history. Drawing on her memory, her parents' written reflections, interviews with contemporaries, and newly available documents, her Prague Winter, a personal story of remembrance and war, 1937 to 1948, is an exploration of the past and a recounting of her intensely personal journey. The book travels from the Bohemian capital's ancient castles to the bomb shelters of London, from the desolate prison ghetto of Theresien to the highest councils of European and American government. Albright, who narrates the work, reflects on her discovery of her family's Jewish heritage many decades after the war, on her Czech homeland's tangled history, on the stark moral choices faced by her parents and their generation. She recounts how millions of ordinary citizens were ripped from familiar surroundings and forced into new roles as exiled leaders and freedom fighters, resistance organizers and collaborators, victims and killers. Quote, no one who lived through the years of 1937 to 48, Albright writes, was a stranger to profound sadness. Millions of innocents did not survive, and their deaths must never be forgotten. Today we lack the power to reclaim lost lives, but we have a duty to learn all that we can about what happened and why.
On a hill in Prague, there is a castle that has stood for 1,000 years. From its windows, one can see a forest of gilded cupolas and Baroque towers, slate roofs, and sacred spires. Visible, too, are the stone bridges spanning the broad and winding Vltava River as its waters flow northward at a leisurely pace. Through the centuries, the beauty of Prague has been enriched by the labor of artisans from a plethora of nationalities and creeds. It's a Czech city, with a variety of accents, at its best in spring when the fragrant blossoms of the lindens burst forth, the forsythia turns gold, and the skies seem an impossible blue. The people, known for their diligence, resilience, and pragmatism, look forward each winter to when the days lengthen, the breezes soften, the trees regain their covering, and the river banks issue a silent summons to play. On the morning of March 15, 1939, that promise of spring had never seemed so distant. Snow lay thick on the castle grounds, winds blew fiercely from the northeast, the heavens were a leaden gray. At the U.S. Embassy, two disheveled men cornered a diplomat en route to his office and begged desperately for asylum. They had been Czechoslovak spies in Germany and were known to the Gestapo. The diplomat, a young Foreign Service officer named George Kennan, turned them away. There was nothing he could do. Czechs had awoken that morning to a startling announcement. Today, at 6 o'clock, German troops crossed our borders and are proceeding to Prague by all routes. Stay calm. The light of dawn was still searching for cracks in the clouds when the first convoy of jeeps and trucks roared by, heading toward the castle. The vehicles, plastered with ice, were driven by red-faced soldiers wearing steel helmets and wool coats. Before long, the people of Prague had had their coffee and it was time to go to work. The sidewalks filled with men and women stopping to gape at the alien procession, defiantly waving their fists, crying, or staring in stony silence. In Wenceslas Square, voices were raised in a spontaneous rendering of patriotic songs. On and on, the mechanized battalions came, penetrating every neighborhood of the ancient city. At the train station, artillery pieces and tanks were unloaded. By mid-morning, heavy-footed Germans were striding purposefully into government ministries, the town hall, prisons, police offices, and barracks. They seized the airfields, deployed field guns on the snow-covered slopes of Petrine Hill, draped flags and banners across the fronts of buildings, and attached loudspeakers to lampposts and trees. Martial law was declared, and a 9 p.m. curfew announced. In the early evening darkness, a motorcade arrived from the north. Its passengers were ushered through the deserted streets, across the river, and up the curving byways to the castle mount. And so that night, the fabled home of Bohemian kings served as headquarters for the ruler of Germany's Third Reich. Adolf Hitler and his top aides, Hermann Göring and Joachim von Ribbentrop, were in an exultant mood. "The Czechs may squeal," the Führer had told his military commanders, "but we will have our hands on their throats before they can shout. And anyway, who will come to help them?"
We've just heard Prague Winter by Madeleine Albright. Did you know that the most creative companies have centralized bathrooms? That brainstorming meetings are a terrible idea? Boy, do I agree with that. And that the color blue can help you double your creative output. From best-selling author Jonah Lehrer comes Imagine How Creativity Works, a sparkling look at the new science of creativity. Shattering the myths of muses, higher powers, even creative types, Lehrer demonstrates that creativity is not a single gift possessed by the lucky few. It's a variety of distinct thought processes we can all learn to use more effectively. Lehrer reveals the importance of embracing the rut, thinking like a child, daydreaming productively, and adopting an outsider's perspective. He unveils the optimal mix of old and new partners in any creative collaboration and explains why criticism is essential. Then he zooms out to show how we can make our neighborhoods more vibrant, our companies more productive, and our schools more effective. Imagine is performed by the author.
In desperation, the team returned to making house visits, hoping for some errant inspiration. One day, the designers were watching an elderly woman sweep some coffee grounds off the kitchen floor. She got out her hand broom and carefully brushed the grounds into a dustpan. But then something interesting happened. After the woman was done sweeping, she wet a paper towel and she wiped it over the linoleum, picking up the last bits of spilled coffee. Although everyone on the Continuum team had done the same thing countless times before, this particular piece of dirty paper led to a revelation. What the designer saw in that paper towel was the possibility of a disposable cleaning surface. All of a sudden, we realized what needed to be done, says Don Buchner, a Continuum vice president. We needed to invent a spot cleaner that people could just throw away. No more cleaning mop heads, no more bending over in the bathtub, no more buckets of dirty water. That was our big idea. A few weeks later, this epiphany gave rise to their first floor cleaning prototype. It was a simple thing, just a slender plastic stick connected to a flat rectangle of Velcro to which disposable pieces of electrostatic tissue were attached. A spray mechanism was built into the device, allowing people to wet the floor with the mild soap before they applied the wipes. The soap was mostly unnecessary, but it smelled nice. You know an idea has promise when it seems obvious in retrospect, Wes says. Why splash around dirty water when you can just wipe up the dirt? And why would you bother to clean the surface? Why not just throw it away like a used paper towel? Procter & Gamble, however, wasn't thrilled with the concept. The company had developed a $1 billion market selling consumers the latest mops and soaps. They didn't want to replace that business with an untested cleaning product. The first focus groups only reinforced the skepticism. When Procter & Gamble presented consumers with a sketch of the new cleaning device, the vast majority of people rejected the concept. They didn't want to throw out their mops or have to rely on a tool that was little more than a tissue on a stick. They didn't like the idea of disposable wipes, and they didn't understand how all that dirt would get onto the moistened piece of paper. And so the idea was shelved. Procter & Gamble wasn't going to risk market share on a radical new device that nobody wanted. But the designers at Continuum refused to give up. They were convinced they discovered the mop of the future. After a year of pleading, they persuaded Procter & Gamble to let them show their prototype to a focus group. Instead of just reading a description of the product, consumers could now play with an experiential model clad in roughly cut plastic. The prototype made all the difference. People were now enthralled by the cleaning tool, which they tested out on actual floors. In fact, the product scored higher in focus group sessions than any other cleaning device Procter & Gamble had ever tested. It was off the charts, Buchner says. The same people who hated the idea when it was just an idea now wanted to take the thing home with them. Furthermore, tests by Procter & Gamble demonstrated that the new product cleaned the floor far better than sponge mops, string mops, or any other kind of mops. According to the corporate scientists, the tissue on a stick was one of the most effective floor cleaners ever invented. In 1997, nearly 3 years after West and his designers began making their videotapes, Procter & Gamble officially submitted an application for a U.S. patent. In the early spring of 1999, the new cleaning tool was introduced in supermarkets across the country. The product was an instant success. By the end of the year, it had generated more than $500 million in sales. Numerous imitators and spin-offs have since been introduced, but the original device continues to dominate the post-mop market, taking up an ever greater share of the supermarket aisle. Its name is the Swiffer. The invention of the Swiffer is a tale of creativity. It's the story of a few engineers coming up with an entirely new cleaning tool while watching someone sweep up some coffee grounds. In that flash of thought, Harry West and his team managed to think differently about something we all do every day. They were able to see the world as it was, a frustrating place filled with tedious chores, and then envision the world as it might be, if only there were a better mop. That insight changed floor cleaning forever. This book is about how such moments happen. It is about our most important mental talent, the ability to imagine what has never existed. We take this talent for granted, but our lives are defined by it.
We've just heard Imagine, How Creativity Works by Jonah Lehrer. Readers, I've just had the pleasure of visiting Portland, Oregon. What a beautiful place, and that city can cook, if you know what I mean. Standing in line at the Voodoo, just wild. But I visited another of Portland's most tempting sights. I am here in an institution in Portland, Powell's Bookstore, and I am speaking today with Bruce Burkhart, one of 10 operations managers here at the store. Welcome, Bruce. Thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Well, thank you for having me. My pleasure.
Tell us a little bit about the history of this amazing place.
Well, you identified it as Powell's Books. I like to refer to it as Powell's City of Books. We've been a bookstore here in Portland for 42 years. I suspect that many of your listeners have heard of us or visited us. We are a bookstore that is a full city block. At the highest point, we're four stories high. We have nearly 1 million books. My pleasure is saying to anyone that our cheapest book is 25 cents and used, because we're a new and used bookstore. And our most expensive currently is a Lewis and Clark Journal for $350,000.
We're actually sitting in the Rare Book Room. Tell us a little about that.
Rare Book Room holds some of the most wonderful books that we have. It's part of the greatest pleasure I get out of working here. I've been here for 17 years. A rare book that finds its way here into this room comes here any number of ways. We seek it out. More often, though, it's a book that walks into our doors by someone who is selling books to us. And between our buyer and the seller, we suddenly discover that they have a very special book. That's sort of the life and times.
The store is divided into many different rooms and areas. Tell us about some of the customer favorites.
Customers' favorites. I'd like to think that every room, and we have nine of them, we have plenty of customer favorites. We have, generally speaking, we get about 3,000 to 4,000 visitors every day to our store. And we have the nine rooms that are all what we deem a color. So we have a gold room, a coffee brown room, a blue room, a green room, an orange room, a rose room, purple, pearl, and red. Each one of them, to the best that we can, serves up a certain subject area. Example, the gold room can be many times the most well-trafficked in a day. It is the genre room, science fiction, fantasy, mystery, horror, all sorts of things.
Many of the biggest names in the literary world have visited here and signed books and done a reading. Can you share some of your favorite highlights?
I will say my favorite author is Chuck Palahniuk, who is a local author, doesn't live here in town anymore. But he, in a good way, has caused us troubles. We once had to tell him to quit shelving our books, and he was not shelving his own books. He was just simply at home and doing some work in our blue room. But I had the great fun of spending quite a bit of time with Matt Groening, world-renowned for his World of Bart Simpson. And again, he used to live here. I don't think he lives here anymore, but nonetheless, he visits quite often and was a great pleasure to meet and spend some time with. The middle school students that I often host here at our store are very disappointed to learn that I have turned Bart Simpson into a history class, because Matt used some of the characters' names borrowing from some of the founders of the city of Portland.
And how many people walk through the door every month?
On average, outside of the holidays, 3,000 to 4,000 a day.
Tell us some more about what's here in the Rare Book Room. It's an amazing place.
It is an amazing place. And one of the best books that I have here in this room is the Lewis and Clark Journals, published in 1814. And what they are for $25,000 is a used working two-volume set. And what I mean by that is somebody in the year 1814 purchased these books, probably in Missouri, and actually used them to travel to the Oregon Territory that we are sitting in right now. So it is certainly wonderful that we here in Portland, Powell City of Books, has this to offer up to someone, but we also have it for others to simply look at and admire. I also had, I sold it, was a book written by John F. Kennedy that he actually inscribed a letter inside of the book, as well as inserted a handwritten letter to a citizen of Oregon.
In walking around the store, I noticed a great diversity of age, and young readers are just as excited about being here as older readers. Can you talk about how the store keeps bringing in people from all different ages?
I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because I think the one question that comes to me more often than not is, what is the thing that excites you the most about working at Powell's? And that answer is not anything to do with the authors who come to visit us or anything. It has to do with the youngest. And I actually spend a length of time working with students from all the school districts in the general area, Oregon and Washington. The excitement that I get when I have a middle school student come and I walk them through the store and show them this world of books. The excitement I get when I see their excitement. And when I find and watch a whole classroom searching out individually, each one of them searching out for a book that they want and finding it. And when I watch them as they are exiting the store, paying no attention to anybody at all except telling their fellow student how excited they are about the book that they have in their hand. That is the thrill of a lifetime. That is what I enjoy the most. I have to say, and tip of my hat to all those authors that present wonderful works that cause those younger people to flock to the bookshelves, because time and time again it happens. Suzanne Collins, J.K. Rowling, all sorts of authors have done this for the younger audience to begin their world and travels through books. And I have no doubts that the language of humans will continue on forever on pages, whatever those pages might look like.
Talk a little about the evolution of Powell's in the world of Kindle and Nook. I mean, I find your store quite crowded. So how is the store evolving with the, you know, electronic revolution?
It is evolving in conjunction with the evolution. If someone were to ask me, will books exist forever? I can't answer that question. I do know that books are cherished by many. And I think that the Kindle, the electronic book, has its place. And I think the book has its place. And that they will share those shelves in homes, whatever that might be, and be forever.
And another way that the store is evolving?
Well, we are moving into a whole new world. It's one that allows a person to walk into our store with their own manuscript that they have never had published. But it allows them to walk into our store, hand that manuscript over to what we are calling the Espresso Book Machine. And the Espresso Book Machine currently, I know that they have one in the Brooklyn Public Library, and it now lives here on the West Coast at Powell's City of Books, which in a matter of minutes, and I think 5 to 10 minutes, generally speaking, a person could hand a script over to them, and they would turn it into a book, turn the pages, and bind it, and hand it to them as a completed book. What does that mean? That means it allows a person who has written a book but has never had it published to do just that, publish it in book form. It allows them actually to put it on a network. Once it is accepted, then they say yes. It allows them to put it on a network to have it available for others. It allows anyone who wants to archive something in book form. For example, a young child who has beautiful artwork that they have collected through this young school years, that what do you do with it? Why not put it into book form? I personally will be turning a recently passed away father, turning his history that he had, which was a wonderful history, turning all of that into a book form to then hand to my family. It's a whole new world. There are many books that are not available that can now become available in book form. And all of that is being offered right here at Powell City of Books with the Espresso Book Machine, which is really kind of neat to look at.
Well, thank you so much. This is an amazing place, and I think anyone who visits Portland has to make this one of their first stops. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you again.
So many folks are talking about this work. The Book Report just had to bring you a preview. The Passage of Power, The Years of Lyndon Johnson, by Robert A. Caro, follows Johnson through both the most frustrating and the most triumphant periods of his career, 1958 to 1964. It was a time when he traded the extraordinary power he'd created for himself as Senate Majority Leader for what became the wretched powerlessness of the vice presidency in an administration that disdained and distrusted him. And it was the time in which the presidency, the goal he had always pursued, would be thrust upon him. For the first time, you see the Kennedy assassination through Johnson's eyes. He stepped into the presidency, inheriting a staff fiercely loyal to his slain predecessor, a Congress determined to retain its power over the executive branch, and a nation in shock and mourning. Within weeks, he propelled essential legislation through Congress, bills that at the time of Kennedy's death seemed hopelessly logjammed. And so began the revolutionary war on poverty. Caro illuminates how the political genius with which Johnson ruled the Senate enabled him to make the presidency his own. Grover Gardner narrates.
When he was young, 17 and 18 years old, Lyndon Johnson worked on a road gang that was building a highway, an unpaved highway. Roads in the isolated, impoverished Texas Hill Country weren't paved in the 1920s, between Johnson City and Austin. With little mechanical equipment available, the road was being built almost entirely by hand, and his job, when he wasn't half of a pick-and-shovel team with Ben Kreider, a burly friend, 6 years older, from Johnson City, was driving a Fresno, a heavy two-handled metal scoop with a sharpened front edge that was pulled by four mules. Standing behind the scoop, between its handles, as the mules strained forward to force the scoop through the hard hill country caliche soil, he would push as they pulled. Since he needed a hand for each handle, the reins were tied together and wrapped around his back. So for this work, hard for even older men, for a tall, skinny, awkward teenager it was, the other men recall, back-breaking labor, too heavy for Lyndon. Lyndon Johnson was, really, in harness with the mules. But at lunch hour each day, as the gang sat eating, in summer in whatever shade they could find as protection from the blazing hill country sun, in winter huddled around a fire, it would get so cold, Kreider recalls, that you had to build a fire to thaw your hands before you could handle a pick and shovel, build us a fire and thaw and work all day. Lyndon would, in the words of another member of the gang, talk big to the older men. He had big ideas. He wanted to do something big with his life. And he was quite specific about what he wanted to do. "I'm going to be president of the United States one day," he predicted. Poverty and backbreaking work, clearing cedar on other men's farms for $2 a day, or chopping and picking cotton on your hands and knees all day beneath that searing sun, were woven deep in the fabric of Lyndon Johnson's youth, as were humiliation and fear. He was coming home at night to a house to which other Johnson City families brought charity in the form of cooked dishes, because there was no money in that house to buy food. To a house on which, moreover, his family was having such difficulty paying the taxes and mortgage that they were afraid it might not be theirs much longer. But woven into it also was that prediction. In many ways, his whole life would be built around that prediction, around a climb toward that single far-off goal. As a young congressman in Washington, he was careful not to mention that ambition to the rising young New Dealers with whom he was allying himself. But they were aware of it anyway. James H. Rowe Jr., Franklin Roosevelt's aide, who spent more time with Johnson than the others, says, "From the day he got here, he wanted to be president. When old friends from Texas visited him, sometimes his determination burst out of him despite himself, as if he could not contain it. "By God, I'll be president someday," he exclaimed one evening when he was alone with Welly Hopkins. And an incident in 1940 showed the Texans how much he wanted the prize he sought, how much he was willing to sacrifice to attain it. Lack of money had been the cause of so many of the insecurities of his youth, and his election to Congress, far from soothing those fears, had seemed only to intensify them. He talked incessantly about how his father, who had been an elected official himself, a six-term member of the Texas House of Representatives, had ended up as a state bus inspector and had died penniless. He didn't want to end up like his father, he said. He talked about how he kept seeing around Washington former congressmen who had lost their seats, as he said he would inevitably one day lose his, and were working in low-paying, demeaning jobs. Over and over again, he related how once, while he was riding in an elevator in the Capitol, the elevator operator had told him that he had been a congressman. Hungry for money, he had already started accepting, indeed soliciting, financial favors from businessmen who wanted favors from him, and had been pleading with two important businessmen, George R. Brown of the Texas contracting firm of Brown and Root, and the immensely wealthy Austin publisher, real estate magnate, and oil man Charles Marsh, to find him a business in which he could make a little money of his own.
That was Passage of Power by Robert A. Caro. The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity, by journalists and presidential historians Nancy Gibbs and Michael Duffy, is an intriguing look at alliances that have changed history. The President's Club was born at Eisenhower's inauguration when Harry Truman and Herbert Hoover first conceived the idea. Over the years that followed, and to this day, presidents are bound to one another because they share the secrets of the Oval Office, yet they are immortal rivals for history's favor. Truman enlisted Hoover to help him save Europe. Kennedy turned to Ike on Cuba. Nixon sought Johnson's advice on getting reelected, but then tried to blackmail him. Ford and Carter couldn't stand each other until they saw what they had in common. Reagan and Clinton relied on Nixon as an off-the-books emissary to Russia. And George W. Bush put Clinton and his father to work. The authors unravel the secret compacts, the shared scars, and the private ceasefires. Bob Walter narrates the book that may change your perspective on the presidency.
The news hounds are trying to drive a wedge between us. Harry Truman. Useful as a former president like Hoover could be to a rookie chief executive, a future president's star power proved just as valuable. In 1945, 1 month after Truman turned to Hoover for help, he made the acquaintance of the hero of Western civilization, General Dwight David Eisenhower, who was every bit as revered as Hoover had been reviled. In those two men, Truman found the allies who would help him shape the post-war world. Like millions of his countrymen, when Eisenhower heard the news of Harry Truman's sudden vault into the presidency upon Roosevelt's death in April 1945, he admitted that he went to bed depressed and sad. It was nothing personal. He had never met the vice president, and Eisenhower had not been one of Roosevelt's pets. But to him and the other generals, this seemed to us to be a most critical time to be forced to change national leaders. He knew better than most people the weight that was about to fall on Truman's shoulders, the new threats rising, even as a great enemy was finally routed. Just a few weeks later, Eisenhower was accepting the German surrender in a small red brick schoolhouse in northeastern France. The signal, Winston Churchill said, for the greatest outburst of joy in the history of mankind. And on June 18, 1945, Truman gave thousands of government employees the afternoon off so they could burst out themselves and greet the supreme commander of what was being called the greatest victory in the history of warfare. A million people jammed the hot flag-wrapped streets of Washington, hung from windows, perched in trees to watch the parade and celebrate at last. Eisenhower arrived in a four-engine Skymaster at Washington's National Airport, where Mamie waited for the husband she had seen only once in the last 3 years. He ran down the steps, caught her in his arms, and kissed her. 20 bands played. Dozens of fighter planes and bombers flew overhead in escort as the parade made its way through the Capitol. A rush and storm of joy swept the city, the New York Times marveled. "Stand up so they can see you," urged General George Marshall. So he stood in his Jeep as it moved down Pennsylvania Avenue, his arms raised, delighted, embarrassed, his grin almost wider than his face. "Isn't he handsome?" said a voice in the crowd. "He waved at me. He's marvelous." Ike arrived at the Capitol to address a joint session of Congress, the Cabinet, ambassadors, and the justices of the Supreme Court, as though he were delivering his first State of the Union, only to an audience far more worshipful than any president of either party had ever faced. Yet every wave and bow, he insisted again and again, he made only as a representative of the 3 million soldiers he commanded. "They who earned your commendation should properly be here to receive it," he said. "But I am nevertheless proud and honored to be your agent in conveying it to them." And the chamber erupted in a great rolling cheer. The U.S. liked what it saw. Time swooned. A kindly, common-sense man, a warrior who remembered that he was a citizen, a son of the Middle West, unhardened by war, unspoiled by fame. That afternoon, the towering hero of the age would meet for the first time the little haberdasher. That was not an easy day for the rookie president. "I have to decide Japanese strategy," Truman wrote in his diary the night before. "That is my hardest decision to date." He met with his war cabinet to discuss the costs of mounting an invasion of the Japanese home islands, and the chance that more than 250,000 U.S. soldiers and many more Japanese civilians would die, unless fate intervened. "We are approaching an experiment with the atom explosion," Truman recorded. "I was informed that event would take place within a possible 30 days. At least the other war was over, and Truman, almost a bystander on a day of adulation, got to thank Eisenhower personally. In a ceremony on the White House lawn, Truman added a second oak leaf cluster to the General's Distinguished Service Medal.
That was a sample of The President's Club by Nancy Gibbs and Michael Duffy. Peking in 1937 was a heady mix of privilege and scandal, opulence and opium dens, rumors and superstition. In Midnight in Peking, how the murder of a young English woman haunted the last days of old China, Paul French recounts how, with the Japanese encircling the city, the discovery of Pamela Werner's body sent a shiver through an already frantic city. Was it the work of a madman, one of the ruthless Japanese soldiers who surrounded the city, or perhaps a dreaded spirit? With the suspect list growing and clues sparse, two detectives, one British and one Chinese, race to solve the crime before the Japanese invade, and Peking, as they know it, is gone forever. Historian and China expert Paul French uncovers the truth behind this notorious murder and offers a rare glimpse of the last days of colonial Peking. Eric Singer narrates.
When daylight broke on another freezing day, the tower was deserted once more. The colony of bats circled one last time before the creeping sun sent them back to their eaves. But in the icy wasteland between the road and the tower, the wild dogs, the Huanggou, were prowling curiously, sniffing at something alongside a ditch. It was the body of a young woman, lying at an odd angle and covered by a layer of frost. Her clothing was disheveled, her body badly mutilated. On her wrist was an expensive watch that had stopped just after midnight. It was the morning after the Russian Christmas, 13 days after the Western Christmas by the old Julian calendar. Peking at that time had a population of some 1.5 million, of which only 2,000, perhaps three, were foreigners. They were a disparate group, ranging from stiff-backed consuls and their diplomatic staff to destitute white Russians. The latter, having fled their homeland to escape the Bolsheviks and revolution, were now officially stateless. In between were journalists, a few businessmen, some old China hands who'd lived in Peking since the days of the Qing dynasty and felt they could never leave. There was the odd world traveler taking a prolonged sojourn from a grand tour of the Orient, who'd come for a fortnight and lingered on for years, as well as refugees from the Great Depression in Europe and America, seeking opportunity and adventure. And there was no shortage of foreign criminals, dope fiends, and prostitutes who'd somehow washed up in northern China. Peking's foreigners clustered in and around a small enclave known as the Legation Quarter, where the great powers of Europe, America, and Japan had their embassies and consulates, institutions that were always referred to as legations. Just 2 square acres in size, the strictly demarcated legation quarter was guarded by imposing gates and armed sentries, with signs ordering rickshaw pullers to slow down for inspection as they passed through. Inside was a haven of Western architecture, commerce, and entertainment, a profusion of clubs, hotels, and bars that could just as easily have been in London, Paris, or Washington. Both the Chinese and foreigners of Peking had been living with chaos and uncertainty for a long time. Ever since the downfall of the Qing dynasty in 1911, the city had been at the mercy of one marauding warlord after another. Nominally, China was ruled by the Kuomintang, or Nationalist Party, under the leadership of Chiang Kai-shek. But the government competed for power with the warlords and their private armies, who controlled swathes of territory as large as Western Europe. Peking and most of northern China was a region in flux. Between 1916 and 1928 alone, no fewer than 7 warlord rulers came and went in Peking. On conquering the city, each sought to outdo the last with more elaborate uniforms, more ermine and braid. All fancied themselves emperors, founders of new dynasties, and all commanded substantial private armies. One of them, Cao Kun, had bribed his way to supremacy, paying officials large amounts in stolen silver dollars, since no official in China at that time trusted paper money. Another, Feng Kuo-chang, had been a violin player in brothels before illegally declaring himself president of all China. They and their ilk terrorized the city as they bled it dry. Peking was certainly a prize. It was China's richest city after Shanghai and Tianjin. Unlike those two, however, Peking was not a treaty port, those places seized from the Qing dynasty by European powers in the 19th century. There, foreigners governed themselves and built trading empires backed by their own police forces, armies, and navies. Peking was, at least for now, Chinese territory.
That was Midnight in Peking by Paul French. On an overcast September day in 1993, Jim Abbott took the mound at Yankee Stadium and threw one of the most dramatic no-hitters in Major League history. The game was the crowning achievement in an unlikely success story. Imperfect and Improbable Life by Jim Abbott with Tim Brown recounts one of the most amazing tales in sports history. Born without a right hand, Jim Abbott dreamed of being a great athlete. Raised in Michigan by parents who would not view his condition as a disability, Jim became a two-sport standout in high school, then an ace pitcher for the University of Michigan. As a 19-year-old, Jim beat the vaunted Cuban national team. By 21, he'd won a gold medal game at the 1988 Olympics and, without spending a day in the minor leagues, cracked the starting rotation of the California Angels. In 1991, he would finish third in the voting for the Cy Young Award. 2 years later, he would don Yankee pinstripes and deliver a one-of-a-kind no-hitter. Sadly, it wouldn't always be so good for Jim. After a season of difficult losses, Jim was released, cut off from the game he loved. Unable to say goodbye, Jim tried to come back, pushing himself to the limit, and through one of the loneliest experiences an athlete can have. In this honest and insightful memoir, Abbott, who narrates, reveals a life spent as the different one.
I spent two baseball seasons in New York and enjoyed them most on Saturday mornings when the city composed itself with a long, slow breath. Maybe it was a sigh. Either way, on this particular Saturday, the sidewalks 27 floors below the apartment window were less cluttered. The taxi hailers appeared in a hurry, but not altogether panic-stricken. The dog walkers smiled and nodded at passers-by as their little city pooches, pleased not to be rushed, did their morning business. Across 90th Street, a broad patch of emerald green, conspicuously so, against the old brick and brownstone and grit, hosted a game of soccer, filling the neighborhood with cries of encouragement, whoops, and applause. The sky was gray, a leaden touch to a yawn-and-stretch morning on Manhattan's Upper East Side. The idle observations from the uniformed lobby doorman and the waitress four blocks away at Gracie's Corner, where the wait was manageable and the pancakes were reliably fluffy, were about afternoon rain, the prospect of which further softened the jostle of the expired work week. I liked it there. Dana and I had carved something like a routine from our first year east. What began as an exercise in survival became almost comfortable. We rented a one-bedroom apartment with a sofa, a coffee table, a couple chairs, bought a few things for the kitchen, and mostly ate out. We were in our mid-20s, a good time for exploration and discovery in a semi-furnished life. At first, we walked the neighborhood, within a few blocks of 90th and York Avenue, browsing the shops and studying the menus taped to the windows before widening the radius to include Central Park and the museums that run practically side by side along Fifth Avenue. We began to smile at familiar and friendly faces, the people with whom we regularly rode the elevator, the guy behind the deli counter a couple doors down, the woman who pushed quarters across the top of a stack of tabloids, change for our newspaper. Amid its swirling rhythms and every man for himself pretenses, New York was becoming a good place for us. We were learning about each other, fending for ourselves, accumulating the scrapes and bruises that come with the outsider's clumsy entrance. I'm not sure the transplants among the city's millions ever believe that life there can be done quite right. There's simply too much one can't know. There being so many wonderful layers of people and cultures, so many siren blips and impulses, and yet many find their spots. There is a life to be had in the spaces of stillness amid the commotion, and that's where we generally succeeded in hosting it. The job wasn't going as well. I walked with Dana that morning with the New York Times under my arm and work on my mind. A man pushed buckets of fresh flowers to the sidewalk, far enough to be tempting to passers-by, not so far as to be out of sight. The paper carried the story of the Yankees' loss last night at the stadium. A Cleveland Indians rookie named Manny Ramirez, raised in New York's own Washington Heights, hitting his first big league home run in front of scores of friends and relatives down the left field line, and two innings later, his second. The Mets had lost in Chicago. The Angels game had gone too late to make the early edition. There may have been a mention of me somewhere within those pages, which I'd chosen not to read. It was early September and beginning to feel like it. The weather was turning and the Yankees were in the race, in second place a couple games behind the Toronto Blue Jays in the American League East. Life and baseball were moving fast, each jostling the other to take the lead as Dana and I stuck to our recent game day habits. Me feeling the anxiety and freshness of a new 5-day cycle, eager for the ball and another shot. Her fretting that I'd lose again and we'd have to relive the previous 4 days. As we walked, we spoke of that afternoon's start against the Indians, what it might bring, then left the conversation as a pile of half-finished thoughts.
That was Imperfect, an Improbable Life by Jim Abbott and Tim Brown. One of the greatest rock icons of all times, Greg Allman has lived it all, and then some. For almost 50 years, he's been creating some of the most recognizable songs in American rock, but he's never paused to reflect on the long road he's traveled, until now. My Cross to Bear, written with Alan Light, tells this unflinching story. It begins simply with Greg and his older brother Dwayne growing up in the South, raising Cain with their guitars, and drifting from one band to another. But all that changed when Dwayne and Greg came together with four other men to forge something new, a unique sound shaped by soul, rock, and blues, brimming with experimentation, and a sound not just of a band, but of a family. Bringing to life the carefree early days of the Allman Brothers Band, Greg holds nothing back, from run-ins with the law to meeting girls on the road, from jamming at the Fillmore East to experimenting with drugs. He goes behind the scenes of some of the greatest rock music ever recorded, without shying away from the painful deaths of Dwayne and the band's bassist, Barry Oakley. Greg offers a tribute to Dwayne that only a younger brother could write, showing how, to this day, he still confronts the grief of losing his big brother. Greg recounts his battles with substance abuse, heading to rehab no less than 11 times, his string of failed marriages, including his relationship with Cher, and his fight to clean up once and for all. Will Patton narrates this tale of the rambling man.
I was born on December 8, 1947, at 3:23 in the morning at the old St. Thomas Hospital in Nashville. It was a beautiful building, all marble and brownstone. Now they've moved to the outskirts of town, but like everybody I've ever known in Nashville. Where were you born? St. Thomas. My brother Dwayne was born on November 20th, 1946, 1 year and 18 days before me. Same hospital, same doctor. In 1949, when I was 2 years old and my brother was three, my father, who was about 30 at the time, came home for Christmas. He had fought in the last part of World War II, and had landed on the beaches at Normandy on D-Day. He'd been a gunnery sergeant and a lieutenant, and he'd just gotten promoted to captain. He was getting the pay, but he hadn't gotten the bars yet. The day after Christmas, he and a friend of his, who was a master sergeant, went out to a tavern that they always went to, just shooting pool and drinking beer. The year before, when he was overseas, my father had ordered a brand new Ford, so he'd gotten one of the first 49 Fords that came off the line. That night, he and his friend took his new car, and they were definitely celebrating being back home. After they'd been there for a bit, this dude at the bar started asking them, "Tell me about the war." He was buying them beers and all this stuff. It got late into the night, and the guy asked them if he could get a ride home, and they said sure. They got up the highway, and my father asked the guy where he lived. He said, "You turn right up here on this dirt road." Of course, back then, the roads in that part of Tennessee barely had asphalt, especially out in the cornfields. They turned and started going on one of those roads through the corn, and when they got to a place where the corn stopped, the dude pulled out an Army 45. He told my daddy to stop and get out, so they did. They're talking and talking, and he thought they had a bunch of money because of the new car and their uniforms and everything. My dad said, "You can have everything. Take the car. Take everything." His friend, the sergeant, said, "Listen, buddy, we don't mean you no harm." And the guy goes, "Oh, you know my name. Now I gotta kill you." It turned out the guy's name was Buddy Green, first name Buddy. Or maybe that was his nickname. Either way, he misunderstood what my daddy's friend had said, and they were in trouble. My father gave some kind of signal, and he and his friend took off running. But the guy got my father three times in the back. He missed the sergeant, I think. At that time in the state of Tennessee, they had a sentence called 99 plus 1, and you couldn't serve the 1 until you'd served the 99. So it was a 100-year sentence, and Buddy Green got that. He recently died in prison, but at one point I started getting these letters from him. I guess one day one of his partners in prison must have said, "Hey, look whose papa you killed." And oh, they were these mournful letters, like, "I'm sorry to the 16th power," over and over. But I never wrote back. Matter of fact, I think I might have done away with the letters. My two uncles, Sam and Dave, sounds like a band to me. They always drummed it into my head not to ever hitchhike or pick up a hitchhiker. And I listened to them. The only time I ever did bum a ride was after my brother called me in March 1969 to come join him and these other four guys to play some music.
That was My Cross to Bear by Greg Allman. Times bestselling author and king of immersion journalism, A.J. Jacobs tackles his most challenging experiment yet in Drop Dead Healthy, one man's humble quest for bodily perfection. Jacobs, who narrates, takes on his mission to radically improve every element of his body and mind, from his brain to his fingertips to his abs. Having lifted his spirit in the year of living biblically and sharpened his mind in the know-it-all, Jacobs had 1 foot left in the self-improvement trinity to become the healthiest man in the world. First, he tackles a complicated web of diet and exercise advice, most of which is nonsensical, unproven, and contradictory. Second, he consults a team of medical advisors. Finally, he subjects himself over the course of 2 years to a grueling regimen of exercises, a range of diets and nutritional plans, and a brutal array of techniques and practices to improve everything from his hearing to his sleep. Jacob's latest work bursts with hilarity and warmth, all the while testing our culture's assumptions and obsessions with what makes good health.
My dread was more focused than any I'd ever experienced. Probably because of my 3 young sons. I want to be around to see them grow up. I want to be there for their graduations, their marriages, yes. But I also want to see them sing their first Led Zeppelin karaoke song and eat their first jalapeno pepper. I want to be around to teach them the importance of having compassion and why the original Willy Wonka is superior to the remake. I worked myself into quite a state by imagining all the memories I'd never have. The thing is, I'm 41. I can no longer take my health for granted. Catching pneumonia is just one sign that I'm deteriorating. My bones are becoming lighter and more porous. My muscles are shriveling. My brain is shrinking. My arteries narrowing. My coordination slowing. I'm losing 1% of my testosterone a year. And I'm fat. Not morbidly obese. I'm what's described as skinny fat. Python that swallowed a goat type of body, which I've learned is the worst kind of fat. So-called visceral fat, which surrounds the liver and other vital organs, is considered much more dangerous than subcutaneous fat, the kind under the skin that causes cellulite. In fact, the size of your waistline is one of the best predictors of heart disease. My wife, Julie, has been nudging me for years about my growing belly. She's got a repertoire. She'll refer to me as Buddha, or she'll ask, "So, when are you due?" When she wants to be especially subtle, she'll just whistle the Winnie the Pooh theme song as she walks by. She tells me she doesn't care about whether or not I look fat. She says she just wants me to take care of myself so I'm around for a while. A couple of years ago, she sat me down at the dinner table, put her hands on mine, looked me in the eyes, and told me, "I don't want to be a widow at 45. "I understand," I replied solemnly. I pledged to join a gym, and at the time I meant it. But inertia is a powerful force. So I did nothing. I continued eating food packed with empty calories, lots of pasta and corn syrupy cereal. There was a notable lack of anything green at my meals, not counting bottles of Rolling Rock. My exercise regimen was just as bad. I hadn't done serious aerobic exercise since college. I got winded playing hide and seek with my sons. And then I found myself in the hospital gasping for air. And so, right about when the nurse came into my room bearing a pill the size of my middle toe, I made a pledge. If I make it out alive, my next project will be about revamping my body.
We've just heard Drop Dead Healthy by A.J. Jacobs. Readers, I know I usually head for the fiction aisle in the bookstore, but after this show, I think you'll agree there are some fabulous nonfiction books that are worthy of your time. Thanks so much for joining me today. See you back here next week on The Book Report.